guests. Everything was visual. No reason to talk to a tower. No requirement to have a radio, even. Two or three or four such rides could be daisy-chained together to cover unfeasible distances in total secrecy, which was the strategy the fourth arrival had employed. He landed for the last time at a flying club near Plymouth, New Hampshire. From where originally, no one knew. Stephen had tried to trace his home ISP, but he couldn't. One moment it seemed to be inside NASA in Houston, Texas, and then the next moment inside the Kremlin in Moscow, Russia. And then Buckingham Palace in London, England. An ingenious piece of software, made for a guy who valued his privacy and could pay the price for the very best. Which obviously this guy could. Stephen drove out to meet him, and the first thing he saw was the bag with his money. It was a soft leather duffel. Maybe not the best quality. Certainly not monogrammed. It was anonymous, therefore disposable. Stephen figured there would be two main ways to do it. He figured some guys would prefer to count it out, one solid brick of bills after another, hand it over one by one, more real that way. Others would just drop a bag and leave it there, a dull, dusty thump, and then they would walk away, without a word, without a backward glance, playing it cool. Hence, disposable bags. The guy had two more pieces of soft luggage, matching, better quality, and then two hard cases. Stephen helped him unload. The guy insisted on moving the big pieces himself. He was a rangy character, tall and solid, maybe 60 years old, with snow-white hair and a brick-red face. He was in jeans and battered boots. From somewhere out west, Stephen thought. Montana, Wyoming, Colorado. For sure. Not Houston or Moscow or London. They packed the stuff in the Mercedes, and Stephen drove south, on a road that stayed mostly in the trees. The guy didn't talk. 30 minutes later, they turned in at the mouth of the track, between the frost-heaved posts, minus their signs. They ran over the bell wire. They drove on through the tunnel. 2 miles, and 10 minutes later, the guy was putting his bags in his room. Then he stepped back out, to the boardwalk, to the parking lot, to cast an eye over a small group of other guys who seemed to be gathering nearby, forming up like a welcome committee, shuffling closer, casually, getting ready to say hi. The first guys in, the early birds. There were three of them so far. First, they all nodded, by way of introduction. Then they started talking, initially about how they got there. A neutral subject. They shared some details. They were partly secretive and partly what-the-hell friendly. One said he had driven down in a Volvo wagon. He turned and pointed at it, parked outside his room. He implied most of the year he lived in a house in the woods. He was a pale, wiry man in a red plaid shirt, maybe 70 years old. Not naturally a talker by the look of him, but right then buoyed up with suppressed excitement. He looked a little feverish, a little damp around the mouth. He was from Maine, the fourth arrival thought. He said drove down, which meant south, which meant he lived to the north. His car said Vermont, but it was sure to be phony. The other big state, a house in the woods. The second guy didn't say where he was from, but he offered a long story about charter flights and phony licenses. A long enough story to include just about every kind of vocal sound necessary to prove the guy had lived a long time in the south of Texas. Not a native. He was about 50. He was a solid guy, restrained by natural country courtesy, as polite as a salesman. But excited, too. The same kind of fever. The same kind of tremor. The third guy was handsome as a movie star, and built like an athlete. Like a tennis player, maybe. Loose and rangy. The kind of guy who was great in college and got no worse for 20 years. He had a certain kind of confidence. Like he belonged. like he was accustomed to admiration. He said he drove up in a car that didn't exist, and did the last lap in a van. He pointed to it. Persian carpets. He was from Western New York or Pennsylvania, the fourth man thought, given his voice and his manner, and the route implied, and the distances, and the way he said drove up. The fourth man asked, "Have you seen them yet?" The second guy said, "Their blind is up, but right now they're hiding in the bathroom." "What are they like?" "They look great." "Can you be more specific?" "I think they're going to be real interesting." The man from Maine took over and said, "They're both 25 years old. They're both strong and healthy. They seem to have a close emotional relationship. We looked at some tapes. She gets impatient with him from time to time, but he catches up in the end. They solve problems together." The second guy said, "She's the brains. No question." "Are they good-looking?" "Plain," the good-looking guy said. "Not ugly." "They both have muscles. He's a farmer and she's a sawmill worker. They're Canadian, so they had healthcare growing up. You could call her strapping. That might be the right word for the woman. For him, not so much. His name is Shorty for a reason. He's compact, but high quality. I have to say, I was very pleased when I saw them." "Me too," said the man from Maine. "I told you," the second man said. "They look great." "How many more players will there be?" "Two more," the guy said, "for a total of six, if they make it." The fourth man nodded. Rules were rules. If you got there late, you got there never. Room 10 is occupied. The clock was ticking from the get-go. There was a cutoff point. No excuses, no exceptions. Hence the air taxis, daisy-chained together. Unfeasible distances. He said, "Why is there no window in their bathroom?" "Don't need one," the second man said. "There are cameras in there. Go over to the house and take a look." Chapter 28. The Reverend Patrick G. Burke insisted on driving as far as his restraining order would permit, which was all the way to the 40-year-old fence, beyond which the road no longer ran anyway. He said he would wait there. Reacher said he didn't have to, but Burke insisted. In turn, Reacher insisted he turn his car around, nose out, not in, ready for a fast getaway in a forward gear, if necessary. Worst case. Turning around in the narrow fenced space made for an awkward maneuver, back and forth, shoulder to shoulder many times. But eventually the task was accomplished. The Subaru sat like a dragster at the start of the strip. Reacher further insisted Burke keep his engine running. Yes, pollution. Yes, the price of gas. But better than fumbling the key. Better than the car not starting. When the time came. If necessary. Worst case. Burke agreed. Then Reacher insisted he feel free to take off without him. Immediately, no warning, at any time at all, for any reason or none, whatever his gut or his instincts told him. "Don't second guess it," Reacher said. "Don't overthink it. Don't wait even half a second." Burke didn't answer. "I mean it," Reacher said. "If they come for you, it means they got past me. In which case, you really don't want to meet them." Burke agreed. Reacher got out of the car. He closed the door. He swung his legs over the fence. He set out walking. The weather was the same. The smells were the same. The heavy ripe fruit, the hot dry grass. He heard the same buzz of the same insects. Overhead was a hawk on the thermals. Two more in the far distance, widely separated. Too far away to tell what kind. Stan would have said it was typical raptor behavior. Each one claimed an exclusive slice of the action. My street corner, your street corner. No trespassing. Like tough guys everywhere. Reacher walked on, looking straight ahead, refusing to glance left at the top of the rise, where they might be waiting and watching, refusing to give them the satisfaction. Let them come to him. He walked on. He got halfway across the orchard, where he had knocked the kid down. There was no sign, no evidence. Maybe a little scuffed grass from tensed-up footsteps. Maybe in a TV show they would make something out of it. But not in the real world. He walked on. He made it all the way to the second fence, undisturbed. All around was peace and quiet and silence. Nothing was moving. Straight ahead the leaves were darker, and the smell was ranker. The sunless shadows looked colder. He glanced back. Nothing doing. He climbed over the fence. Ryantown, New Hampshire. He walked down Main Street, like the day before, stepping between swaying pipe-thin trees, stumbling now and then on tipped-up stones, passing the low remains of the church and the school. He picked his way onward to the Four Flats, to the right-hand foundation, to the remains of the kitchen in the far back corner, the fragment of tile. He pictured his grandfather, like a clean-shaven blackbeard, yelling and screaming and throwing punches and knocking people down. Probably drinking. He pictured his grandmother, hard and cold and sour, never smiling, never saying a nice thing, always looking cross, angrily sewing the kind of bedsheets she would never get to use. He pictured his father, crawling around on the floor. Or not. Maybe sitting quietly in a corner, staring out the window, at a teeming patch of sky. Your dad joined the Marines at 17, Carter Carrington had said. Got to be a reason. He stood there for a long moment more, and then he said his goodbyes to the place. He turned and retraced his steps, out the kitchen, through the hallway, past the trees, through the lobby, out the street door. No one there. Nothing but peace and quiet and silence all over again. He walked back up Main Street. He stopped at the school. Up ahead, the street bent around to meet the church. Without 60 years of trees, the vista would have been wide open. A person would have seen a big patch of sky. Maybe right there was their bird-watching spot, where they saw the hawk. Maybe the binoculars belonged to the school. A grant from the county, communally owned, not to be taken away. Or maybe a kindly teacher had found them in a junk shop and laid out a couple of bucks. He walked on. He passed the church. He got back to the fence. Ryantown's city limit. Ahead of him was the orchard, where the road used to be. A straight shot, 100 yards, to the parked Subaru, which was still there. It was clearly visible in the distance. Between it and him were only 2 points of interest. The more distant was Burke himself. He was standing in the space between the back of his car and the safe side of the fence, and he was hopping from foot to foot, and jumping up and down, and waving his arm. The second point of interest was 50 yards closer, halfway across the orchard, strung out across the width of the stolen road, was a line of 5 men. Overhead, the hawk circled slowly. Reacher climbed the fence. He left the mossy tangle of unchecked nature behind him, and walked between orderly lines of pruned and identical trees. Up ahead, the 5 men stood still. They were shoulder to shoulder, but not quite touching. They looked like a singing group, about to start up with a tune, like a barbershop quartet plus one. Maybe an alto. 2 tenors, a baritone, and a bass. In which case, the bass would be the guy in the center. He was bigger than the others. Reacher was pretty sure he hadn't seen him before. Also, he was pretty sure the older guy was standing on the big guy's right. The middle generation. Better jeans, cleaner shirt, grayer hair. The other 3 were the same as the night before. Minus the one that got popped. Big, healthy specimens. But no military service, or prison time, or secret sessions with Mossad. He walked on. They waited. Way beyond them in the distance, Burke was still hopping up and down and waving his arm. Reacher wasn't sure why. As a warning, it would always be too late, because of the linear geometry. He would see the problem before he saw the warning, which made no sense. Maybe Burke was offering tactical advice. Do this, then do that. But Reacher couldn't understand the semaphore, and he felt it would likely be superfluous anyway. No doubt a man like Burke had many and various talents, but brawling didn't seem to be one of them. Not so far. Maybe it was just general agitation. Reacher walked on. The guy in the center of the line of five was tall and wide and shaped like an artillery shell. He had a small head set on a thick bull neck fully 4 inches wider than his temples. Below that, his shoulders sloped down, smooth and fast, like a sea creature. He had a big barrel chest, which made his arms and legs look short. He looked young and fit and strong. He was a wrestler, Reacher thought. Maybe once a high school star, then a college star, now an apple picker. Was there a big leagues for college wrestlers? If so, the guy hadn't made it. That was clear. But still, he was big. 20 yards to go. They waited. The wrestler was staring dead ahead. He had tiny dark eyes set back deep in his tiny head. Not much expression, altogether passive. Hence his relative lack of success in the post-college world, perhaps. Perhaps he lacked drive. Perhaps he failed to interpret the world around him. In which case, too bad. He was going to have to suck it up. He had been warned. Obviously. He had been drafted as a replacement. There was a clue in the word. He knew what he was getting into. He could have declined. 15 yards to go. The older guy was glancing left and right at his troops. He looked mostly excited. He was about to see some real good fun. But he was a little anxious, too, in a faraway corner of his mind, which he knew was crazy. How could they lose? It was a slam dunk, surely. But he couldn't shake the feeling. Reacher saw it in his face. He helped it along, any way he could. The slow walk, the long strides, the loose shoulders, the hands away from the sides, the head up, and the eyes hard on the guy. The primitive signal, learned long ago. 10 yards out. The older guy couldn't shake the feeling. It was right there in his face. Suddenly, he looked like he was working on a contingency plan. A potential change of tactics, just in case, as an alternative. He looked ready to shout new orders, which made him a legitimate target, even though he was 50-something and soft. He was a commander in the field. Rules of engagement. They were what they were. He was going to have to suck it up, too. Reacher figured the other three would run away, or at least they would back off, palms out, and they would stammer their way through some kind of not-our-idea plea deal. Loyalty had its limits, especially to promises of menial labor from people who were pretty much assholes anyway. They would run. 5 yards to go. Reacher believed in staying flexible, but also having a plan, and in his experience it was about 50-50 which got used in the end. On this occasion, the plan was to never slow down, to arrive at full speed, and to headbutt the wrestler mid-stride, which would check all the boxes. Surprise, overwhelming force, general shock and awe. With a convenient ethical twist. Literally. It would leave the older guy perfectly situated for a left hook, which was Reacher's weaker hand, which was about as humane as he could see how to make it. But it turned out flexibility was better. Because of the wrestler. He dropped into some kind of combat stance, like a theatrical pose, like a photographer was egging him on, telling him to bring it. Maybe for the front page of the local newspaper. High school star wins trophy. That kind of thing. The guy was giving it his best shot, wasn't really working. He looked like a fat kid pretending to be a grizzly bear. Stubby arms, like claws, at the ready. Kind of crouching, knees bent, feet apart. So Reacher modified the plan, on the fly. West Point would have been proud of him. He preserved the essentials and altered only the details. He never slowed down. He arrived at full speed. But instead of headbutting the guy, he kicked him in the balls. A sudden target of opportunity, because of the feet apart. He got him with pace and momentum and a vicious scything upswing and a dead-on perfect connection. A football would have left the stadium. It came out both good and bad. The good part was it put him exactly where he should be, ready for the left hook, which he delivered. It was short and choppy by classical standards, not elegant at all, not much more than a whipped-in clout. But it was effective. Bang! Daddy went down sideways. His command influence was terminated. The bad part was the wrestler was wearing an athletic protector. A cup. Smart kid. He had interpreted the world. He had prepared. Even so, he had taken a heavy blow. Like a blunt cookie cutter smashing down on tough and gristly dough. But he wasn't disabled. He was still on his feet, stumping around, breathing hard. Shock, yes. Awe, not so much. Which meant the other three guys didn't run away. They didn't back off, palms out, pleading. Instead, they crowded in a step, a blocking maneuver, to let their quarterback recover behind them. Reacher thought, damn, the vagaries of chance. He should have stuck to the original plan. The guy wasn't wearing a football helmet. He wanted to back off a pace, to reset the geometry. But he didn't let himself. It would send the wrong message. Instead, he hit the guy crowding nearest, a solid shot to the gut, which doubled the guy over, his face on his knees, puking and gasping. So Reacher hit him again, with an elbow chopped down hard against the back of the guy's head, which planted him face first in the grass. Game over right there. So Reacher stepped left and lined up the next guy. No delay. Nothing to be gained by standing around shooting the breeze. Better just to set them up and knock them down. But the next guy was barged out of the way, by the wrestler coming through the line. His hands were out and his body was all swelled up with rage. He shoved another guy out the way. He was coming on like a dump truck. Then he planted his feet. He crouched. Face to face, like the start of a bout, he glared. He snarled. Reacher thought, okay then. He knew squat about wrestling. He had never tried it, never felt the need. Too sweaty, too many rules, too much like a last resort. He believed a fight should be won or lost long before it came to rolling around on the floor. In the distance, Burke was still jumping up and down and waving his arm. The wrestler moved. His body turned like a single rigid unit, and he thumped his right foot down, just ahead of where it had been before. Then he turned the other way. Just as rigid, and he thumped his left foot down. Like sumo. Now he was half a step closer. He was maybe a couple inches shorter than Reacher, but probably 20 pounds heavier. He was a big, solid guy. That was for damn sure. He was all hard, sleek muscle, smoothed out into a fluid shape, as if by passage through air or water. Like a bull seal, or a mortar shell. A replacement. Not exactly, Reacher thought. The guy was an improvement. He was there to strengthen the roster. He was specialist talent, drafted in for the occasion, after the lessons of the night before. Maybe he had been borrowed from a friend of a friend. Maybe he was a nightclub bouncer. In Manchester. Or even Boston. Maybe that was the big leagues for college stars. Reacher decided to stay clear of his arms. Wrestling was all about grabbing and grasping and grappling. The guy was probably good at it, or at least experienced. He probably knew all kinds of follow-up tricks. He would know a dozen different ways to get his opponent down on the mat, which would be a fate best avoided. A horizontal struggle would be a problem. Too much bulk. It could end up like trying to bench press a whale. Fortunately, the guy's arms were not long. The exclusion zone was not large. There was some scope for action. Something could be done. But what, exactly? For once in his life, Reacher wasn't sure. The headbutt was still a possibility, but risky, because it meant stepping right into the bear claw grasp. And maybe the guy knew enough to twist away and take the blow on his neck, which up close looked about as sensitive as an automobile tire. Body shots could be delivered, fast right-left-right combinations, like working with the heavy bag. But the guy was built with a kind of slabby construction that would feel like punching a bulletproof vest, with about as much effect. The wrestler moved again. The same dramatic maneuver. Again, like sumo. Reacher had seen it on the television. In the afternoons, in motels. Grainy orange pictures. Huge men in fancy loincloths. Blank and oiled and implacable. Now the guy was a whole step closer. Overhead, the hawk circled slowly. Too late, Reacher realized what the guy was going to do, which was to barge forward, leading with his stomach, again like the sumo on the television. Except in that case, the other guy was also doing the exact same thing, so they met in the middle with a loud slap. But Reacher wasn't moving at all, which meant the other guy had all the momentum to himself, which meant Reacher was about to get hit hard, like getting run over by a tractor tire. He ducked and twisted and flung a Hail Mary right hook into the guy's side, which landed hard, and therefore, according to Isaac Newton's laws of equal and opposite reactions, took some momentum out of the equation. But the guy's barreling bulk was basically unstoppable, and Reacher was spun around and bounced away. And then he had to twist again to avoid a bear claw swinging out toward him. He staggered backward, flailing his arms, trying to stay on his feet. The wrestler charged again. He was nimble for a guy built like a walrus. Reacher ducked away and got a weak jab into the guy's kidney as he passed. It made no discernible difference. The guy reversed direction with a neat 1-2 shuffle and came barreling back again, hot and fierce and feinting left and right, looking to get a grip. Best avoided. Reacher stepped back, and again, and the guy came on, and Reacher launched a straight right to the guy's face, which was like punching the wall of a rubber room. And then he ducked away, low down under the bear claw's swing, and came back up and twisted and got a hard left hook into the guy's back, before bouncing away out of range. Now the wrestler was breathing hard. He had run around a little and taken 2.5 decent body shots. Soon he would be stiffening up. Reacher stepped back. Underfoot the ground was lumpy. On his left was a windfall apple, bright like a jewel on the sunburned grass. The two surviving guys from the night before were creeping nearer, smelling blood. Overhead, the hawk was still circling. The two surviving guys formed up and fanned out, a step ahead of the wrestler. Flank support. Or a chase-down crew. Maybe they expected him to run. The wrestler dropped down into his combat stance. Reacher waited. The wrestler charged. Same as before. A low-down swarming thrust off bent and powerful legs, and a high-speed waddle, leading with the stomach, aiming to use it like a battering ram. Reacher swayed left, but his foot caught in an undulation, and the guy hit him a glancing blow with his charging shoulder, which felt like getting run over by a truck. Twice, first with the original impact and then immediately again with its equal and opposite echo as he hit the ground. Right shoulder first, then his head, then his body, then a tangle of limbs. The guy was nimble and came straight back. Reacher rolled away, but not fast enough. The guy got in a kick that caught him high on the back and rolled him faster. A rare position for Reacher to be in, but not unknown. Rule one was get the hell up right now. So was rule two and three. Staying down was one foot in the grave. So he waited until he rolled face down and then sprang upright like he was a gym rat showing off after 50 push-ups. Now he was breathing hard and swelling up with anger. He was pretty sure kicking wasn't in the rules of wrestling. The game had changed. He thought, okay then. The wrestler dropped down into his combat stance again, and Reacher saw what he should have seen before, or would have seen before, if the game had changed a little sooner. He waited. The wrestler charged, a low-down swarming thrust off bent and powerful legs. Reacher stepped in and kicked him in the knee, just as hard as he had kicked him in the cup, with the same scything upswing and an equally perfect connection. Plus, the guy ran right into it. He brought all his own momentum to the party. A football would have left two stadiums. The result was spectacular. The knee was any heavy guy's weak spot. A knee was a knee. A humble joint. It was what it was. It didn't get bigger and stronger just because a guy chose to spend a whole semester lifting weights. It just got more and more stressed. In this case, it more or less exploded. The kneecap shattered or dislocated, and maybe a whole bunch of stuff was severed inside, because the guy went down like his strings were cut. And then the same Rule 1 instinct bounced him upright again, immediately, howling, standing on one leg, waving the bear claws for balance. The two surviving guys stepped back a pace, like the stock market. Investments can go down as well as up. Behind them in the distance, Burke was standing still and watching, peering anxiously, pressed up tight against the fence. From that point on, Reacher opted for brutal efficiency. Style points no longer mattered. The wrestler threw a despairing bear claw at him, and Reacher caught it and jerked him off balance, and he went down again, awkwardly, clumsily, whereupon Reacher kicked him in the head, once, twice, until he went still. Reacher stood up straight and breathed out, and in, and out. The two surviving guys stepped back another pace. They shuffled in place and tried to look, aw-shucks, sheepish. They raised their hands, palms out. They patted the air in front of them, surrendering, but also distancing themselves, making a point. Not our idea. Reacher asked them, "Where did you find this tub of lard?" He kicked the wrestler one more time in the ribs, but gently, as if merely to indicate which particular tub of lard he was talking about. No one answered. "You should tell me," Reacher said. "It's important to your futures." The kid on the right said, "He came up this morning." "From where?" "Boston. He lives there now, but he grew up here. We knew him in high school." "Did he win trophies?" "Lots of them." "Get lost now," Reacher said. They did. They ran south, at a sprint, up the slope, knees and elbows pumping. Reacher watched them go. Then he picked his way through the vanquished and walked on through the orchard. Burke was waiting at the fence. He held up the hand he had been waving. In it was his phone. "It kept trying to ring," he said, "but there's really no service here. So I walked back to where I got half a bar. It was the ornithologist. He was returning your call from the university. He said it was his only chance to talk because he's tied up the rest of the day. So I ran back here and tried to attract your attention." "I saw," Reacher said. "He left a message."
"On the phone?"
"With me."
Reacher nodded. He said, "First, I need to call Amos at the Laconia PD."
Chapter 29. The fifth arrival was as unobtrusive as the first and the third. In the back parlor, Mark and Stephen and Robert heard the bell ring from the wire across the blacktop. They watched the screens. Robert lined up three different views of the track. They waited. 2 miles took 4 minutes at 30 miles an hour, and 6 minutes at 20. Call it 5 minutes on average, depending on how fast a person was prepared to drive, and what kind of vehicle they had. The surface could be jolting. It was 5 minutes and 19 seconds exactly, according to the digital clocks in the bottom right-hand corners of the screens. They saw a pickup truck come out of the trees and into the light. Robert used a joystick and zoomed the close-up camera tight on it.
It was a Ford F-150, single cab, long bed, dirty white paint, close to a base specification, 3 or 4 model years old, a working man's vehicle, a tool of a trade. Robert tightened the shot some more to check the license plate. It said Illinois, which they all knew was bullshit. The guy was from New York City. His office ISP was unbreakable, but his home Wi-Fi was wide open. He ran a fund on Wall Street. He was one of the new faceless super rich no one had ever heard of. Mark was keen to impress him. He thought Wall Street could be a key market, the right kind of people, with the right kind of needs, and the right kind of money. They watched him drive through the meadow and bump down off the track into the motel lot. They saw him stop outside the office. They saw Peter come out to greet him. They shook hands and exchanged pleasantries. Peter gave him a key and pointed, room 11, the absolute prime location. Significant in every way, their bed and your bed were almost touching, head to head. Symmetrical, separated only by the width of a wall, just a matter of inches. Room 11 was the VIP enclosure, no doubt about it, an honor not to be given lightly. But Mark had insisted. Demographics were important, he had said. Robert clicked mice and tapped keyboards and arranged the screens so they could see just about everything at once, all around them on the walls, one picture overlapping the next. Some of the angles different, like a clumsy attempt at virtual reality. They saw the Wall Street guy park his truck beyond the dead Honda. They saw him detour for a look in room 10's window. Nothing doing. He walked back. He looked like Wall Street. Decent haircut. Fit from the gym, tan from a lamp and weekends at his wife's summer rental in the Hamptons. He was dressed well, even though they supposed he was trying not to be. To match the everyday truck, his closet had failed the challenge. His luggage was 2 hard cases and a soft nylon duffel, all of them dusty from the open bed. Plus, last of all, from the passenger seat, a plastic bag from a New York deli, stuffed with what were either potatoes or rolls of money. Meanwhile, the first 4 arrivals were gathering close by, forming up, sliding from screen to screen, getting ready to talk, or try to, or at least to rock from foot to foot until someone said something. Male bonding. Sometimes a slow process. Robert turned up the sound. There were hidden microphones all up and down the length of the motel, aided by what was painted to look like a TV dish, but was really a parabolic microphone, as sensitive as a bat's ear, aimed down the row at the patch of dirt outside room 10's window, where folks were likely to cluster. Overkill, electronically. But Mark had insisted. Consumer feedback was important, he said. The more raw and unfiltered, the better. Best of all, when they didn't know anyone was listening. They listened. The voices were tinny and a little distorted. There were guarded greetings, the same as before, and the same war stories from the road, about getting there on time and undetected, and the same description of Patty and Shorty themselves, as specimens, in terms of their health and strength and general appeal. Then the consumer feedback turned a little negative. Mark looked away, disappointed. On the screens, a small schism had opened up. There were 2 opposing factions, separated by 1 vital difference between them. Arrivals number 1, 2, and 3 had actually seen Patty and Shorty through their window, live and in the flesh, right there, after their blind went up. Arrivals number 4 and 5 had not. By then, Patty and Shorty were hiding in their bathroom, which had no damn window. So theirs was a 2-point complaint. If everyone was starting out equal, like they should, free country, level playing field, and so on and so forth, then wait until everyone had gotten there, surely, and then raise the damn blind like a ceremony, like a special occasion, with everyone lined up to witness it. Or at least put a window in the damn bathroom. One thing or the other. In the parlor, Mark said to the others, "I don't see how we could put a window in the bathroom. Not with plain glass, anyway. Too weird. But anything else wouldn't work. You couldn't see in." Stephen said, "We could use a plastic sheet on the outside. Some kind of design on it. So it looked pebbled from the inside. Then we could peel it off when we're ready." "You're dodging the issue," Robert said. "We screwed up with their blind. Simple as that. The guy is right. We should have left it down until everyone got here." Mark said, "Patty wanted to see the sunshine." "What are we now? Social workers?" Her mood might prove critical. "How's her mood now?" "Relax," Mark said. "Think outside the box. What's done is done. And as it happens, we did it at the exact halfway point. Three saw them and three won't. We could think of it as a reward for punctuality, like a bonus threshold, like we're offering something. We could call it marketing. Punctual means on time, not early. We should treat them all equally. Too late. Never too late to fix a mistake. How? You get on the mic with Patty and Shorty, and you remind them, you warned them about this earlier, and you say, but maybe they didn't realize exactly what they were getting themselves into. So now, for their own comfort, we have taken a unilateral decision to close their blind again for them. And we do right away. They'll hear it. They'll come out of the bathroom. Meanwhile, we apologize to arrivals 4 and 5, and we tell them we'll have a proper ceremony later, after Patty and Shorty have calmed down again, when we're all assembled. Maybe as the sky goes dark. We could suddenly raise the blind and light up the room both at the same time. I bet we would catch them right there on the bed. It would look like Saks Fifth Avenue on Christmas Day. People would come from miles around. That doesn't solve the problem, Mark said. All it means is three people will have seen them once and three people will have seen them twice. That's not equal. Best we can do, Robert said, as a gesture, which could be important. We can't let this become an issue. You know how they talk in the chat rooms. Word of mouth can make you or break you. We should be seen to go the extra mile to put this right. Mark was quiet a long moment. Then he glanced at Stephen, who said, "I guess." Mark nodded. He said, "Okay." Robert clicked a switch labeled Room 10, Window Blind, down. His voice came out of the ceiling, like before. In the bathroom, it was just as loud as it had been in the main room. He said, "Guys, I apologize. Most sincerely. My fault entirely. I wasn't clear enough when we spoke earlier. About the downside of seeing the view, I mean. So we put it right for you. The blind is down again now and will stay down as long as you want. I'm sure you'll be more comfortable that way. Again, I apologize. I was thoughtless." Patty said, "What do you want with us? What's going to happen to us?" "We'll discuss what we want with you before the end of the day." "You can't keep us here forever." "We won't," Mark said. "I promise. You'll see. Not forever." Then there was a small electronic pop, and the ceiling went quiet again. In the silence, Shorty said, "Do you believe him?" "About what?" Patty said. "The blind being down again." She nodded. "I heard it," she said. Shorty got up stiffly from his spot on the floor, and he opened the door just a crack. He knew right away. There was no bar of daylight, just gloom. "I'm going through," he said. "It's uncomfortable in here." "They're going to raise it again." "When?" "Probably when we least expect it." "Why?" "Because they're messing with us." "Soon?" "Probably not. They'll wait a while. They'll want us to build up a sense of security. So it's safe for a spell. Right now. Then later we could nail up a sheet." "Could we?" "Why not?" Shorty said. In the past, she would have objected purely on the grounds of good manners. Being Canadian, Both the sheet and the wall would be damaged, surely. But now all she said was, "Do you have nails and a hammer?" "No," Shorty said. "Shut up, then. Save your breath to cool your porridge." "Sorry," he said. He stood at the door for a moment. Then he went through. He was sore from sitting, with his butt on one kind of cold tile and his back on another. He lay down on the bed and stared up through the dark at the ceiling. Somewhere there was a camera. He couldn't see it. The plaster was smooth all over. So it was in the light fixture or the smoke alarm. Had to be. Probably not the light fixture. Too hot, surely. Secret spy cameras were presumably delicate. Circuit boards and tiny transmitters. So it was in the smoke alarm. He stared at it. He imagined it staring back at him. He imagined smashing it with a hammer. He imagined fragments raining down. He imagined the hammer still in his hand. What would he smash next? He got up off the bed again and went back in the bathroom. He closed the door. He set the faucet running in the sink. Patty watched him from her spot on the floor. He bent down low, close to her ear, and he spoke in a whisper. He said, "I was thinking, suppose I had a hammer, what would I do?" "Nail up a sheet," she whispered back. "I meant after that," he said. "What after that?" "I would come in here. This is the back of the building. All the action is at the front. The bullshit with the blind and people looking in. Maybe no one is watching the back. The wall is nothing but a skin of tile, then half an inch of wallboard, then a 6-inch void between the studs, maybe packed with insulation, plus maybe a vapor barrier, and then cedar siding nailed on 16-inch centers. So? If I had a hammer, I would bust my way through. We could walk away. Through the wall? A proper demolition crew could do it in a second. That would be routine. Then it's a shame you don't have a hammer. I figure we could use the suitcase on the tile, like a battering ram. We could swing it with the new rope handle, like 1, 2, 3. I bet the tile would come off all in a sheet. Then I could kick the rest of the way through. You can't kick through cedar siding. Don't need to, Shorty said. All I need is to pop it off the studs from the inside, where it's nailed on, with sudden outward force, which should be easy enough. Then it would fall away by itself. All I would need to actually kick my way through would be the wallboard, which should also be easy enough. That stuff ain't strong. How wide of a gap would there be? I think about 14 inches, effectively. We could step through sideways. With the suitcase? Something we got to accept, Shorty said. We need to be realistic. The suitcase stays here until we capture a vehicle. Patty said nothing for a moment. Then she whispered, "Capture a what?" "Some of these guys peering in the window must have driven here, which means there must be cars in the lot now. Or maybe they all got picked up in a Mercedes SUV. In which case, it's still out there, neatly parked somewhere, all warmed up and ready to go. If we can't find it, no matter, because there are plenty more in the barn, which ain't far away. I bet all the keys are hanging up on a neat little board. So first we destroy their property, and then we steal their car. You bet your ass we do. This feels as crazy as the quad bike thing." The quad bike thing wasn't crazy. It worked perfectly. You know that. We saw it working perfectly, every minute, beginning to end. It was something else that didn't work perfectly. We didn't know they had cameras and microphones. We didn't know they were cheating. "Just theoretically," Patty said, "how long would it take to kick through a wall?" "Not long. If we kept the hole a limited size. If we kept it low down to the ground. If we were prepared to crawl out, hands and knees. How long in minutes?" Shorty closed his eyes. He visualized. 8 kicks, 6 with the toe, to crack the wallboard in strategic locations, and then 2 mighty blows with the flat of the sole to punch it all out. Call it 8 seconds overall, Plus then time to tear the insulation out, handful after handful, a blur, like a dog digging up a treasure. Call it another 8 seconds, or 10. Call it 12 seconds, to be on the safe side. So far a total of 20. But then came the siding. Popping it off the studs would not be easy. It was fixed on with big nails shot out of a gun. Heavy blows would be required. The problem was the angle of attack. He would have to direct low karate-style kicks through a narrow opening, kind of sideways and downward. Not practical. Hard to develop maximum power. Better to lie on his back. A downward stamping motion would translate to maximum outward force, over and over again. 8 times at least. He said, 1 minute maybe? She said, that's pretty good. If the tile comes off all in a sheet, what if it doesn't? We would have to bust off every piece separately, just to get to the wallboard in the first place. Then from that point onward it would be a minute. Except probably 2, because by then we would be tired from busting off the tile. How long altogether? Shorty said, just hope it comes off all in a sheet. She said, are we really going to do this? I vote yes. When? I say right now. We could run straight for a quad bike. Might be better than a car. We could ride it through the trees. They wouldn't be able to follow. Except on another quad bike. They have 8 more. We would have a head start. Do you know how to drive a quad bike? How hard can it be? Patty was quiet another long moment. 1 step at a time, she said. First we'll test the suitcase on the tile. We'll see if it comes off all in a sheet. If it does, then we can go ahead and make a final decision. If it doesn't, we can go ahead and forget it anyway.
Shorty opened the bathroom door and glanced across the room at the suitcase. It was still where he had put it down, all those hours before. After he had watched Carol drive away in the tow truck, he whispered, they'll see me get it, because of the camera. They don't know what's in it, Patty whispered back. We're allowed to take our own stuff in the bathroom, surely. We might need it. We might choose to sleep in here, what with people looking in the window all the time. That would be perfectly natural. Shorty paused. He nodded. He went to get the suitcase. Cool as a cucumber. Perfectly natural. He strolled over and hefted it up and strolled back. He put it down and closed the door. Then he breathed out and flapped his hand to ease the pain in his palm. They picked their spot, to the left of the sink. A blank patch of wall. No outlets. Therefore no hidden cables inside to snarl things up. No pipes inside either. The water came and went all in one place, on the other side of the room. Perfect. Plain sailing. They pulled and shoved the suitcase until it was in position. They stood facing each other, with the case between them. They bent down over it, and they grabbed the rope with all 4 hands. They lifted the case 6 inches off the floor to clear the baseboard at the bottom of the wall. They moved away a step, and they set the suitcase swinging, gently, back and forth, back and forth. It was a big, sturdy item. Very old. A plywood shell, covered in heavy leather, with reinforcements on the corners. They perfected their rhythm. They let the weight do the work. On each swing they made 1 arm short and 1 arm long, to keep the suitcase exactly level, like a piston, so its blunt end would hit the wall square on. Ready? Shorty said. Yes. On 3. They swung once, and twice, gathering momentum, and on 3 they stepped in toward the wall and accelerated the weight as hard as they could. The case smacked against the tile. The result was not what Shorty expected. His instinctive prediction had been that the wallboard would flex inward a fraction, which would cause the skim coat to crack off. The tiles were cemented to the skim coat. If the skim coat flaked off, the tiles would come down with it, in sheets. Gravity would see to that. Didn't happen. Instead, 6 tiles shattered into pieces. Some of the broken bits rained down on the floor,
Others stayed up on the wall, like random coin-sized fragments, still solidly glued to separate coin-sized daubs of adhesive. A cheap job. The tiler had buttered 3 or 4 knobs of cement on the back of a tile, and then pressed it into place, one after another, over and over. All the unbuttered voids behind them had made them shatter on impact, but the wallboard itself hadn't flexed at all. They put the suitcase down. Shorty pressed his thumbnail in the space between 2 surviving fragments. The skim coat was right there, dry and smooth and creamy. It was hard and rigid. He scraped at it. It powdered a little. He pressed harder with the ball of his thumb, and then with his knuckles, and then harder still with his fist. The wallboard didn't yield. Not even a tiny fraction. It felt solid. "Weird," he said. "Should we try again?" Patty asked. "I guess," he said. "Real hard this time." They backed off as far as the width of the room would allow, and they swung the case once, through a big, healthy arc about 1 yard long, and then again, and on 3 they staggered sideways and smashed the case into the wall as hard as they could. Same result. A couple more orphan fragments fell off the wall. Nothing more. It was like hitting concrete. They felt the shock in their wrists. They dragged the case out the way. Shorty tapped on the wall, experimentally, here and there, in different places, like knocking on a door. The sound it made was strange. Not exactly solid, not exactly hollow. Somewhere in between. He stepped back and kicked out hard, and again, harder. The whole wall seemed to bounce and tremble as a single unit. "Weird," he said again. He picked up a jagged shard of tile and used it to scrape at the skim coat. He made a long furrow and deepened it, working back and forth, stabbing and scraping. Then he made another furrow and another in a wide triangle, missing some of the still-stuck fragments, including others inside the lines. Then he stepped back and kicked out again, hard, aiming carefully. The scored around triangle of skim coat flaked off and fell to the floor. Under it was revealed the papery surface of brand new wallboard. He attacked it with the shard of tile, furiously, hacking and gouging, spraying dust and curls of torn paper all around. Then he stepped back again and kicked and kicked and kicked in a frenzy of frustration. He kicked the wallboard to fragments and powder. He pulverized it. He reduced it to nothing. But he didn't kick his way through it. He couldn't. It was backed by some kind of thick steel mesh, which came into view, section by section, as the wallboard in front of it was destroyed. It loomed up through the cloud of dust and particles, white and ghostly and tightly woven. It was a net, with steel filaments as thick as his finger, running up and down and side to side. The holes they made were grudging and square, about big enough to put his thumb in, but nothing better. He used the shard of tile to cut more wallboard away. He found a place where a bright green ground wire was soldered to the back of the mesh, like an electrical connection. A very neat job. A random yard away, he found another. Same thing. A ground wire, soldered to the back of the mesh. Then he found a place where the mesh was welded to a prison bar. There was no doubt about it. He knew from the size, and the shape, and the spacing, like on every cop show ever made. There were floor-to-ceiling prison bars built inside the wall. The mesh was spot-welded to it, here and there, like a curtain, like a sheet nailed over a window. He knew why it was there. Because of the ground wires. Because of a long-ago memory of a build-your-own electronics kit he had gotten at Christmas. When he was a kid, from his uncle. Same uncle who gave him the Civic, as a matter of fact. The mesh wasn't there for reinforcement. It was there because it made the room a Faraday cage. Room 10 was an electronic black hole. Any radio signal trying to get in would splinter every which way through the mesh, and then drain away to ground through the many carefully soldered wires. Like the signal never existed at all. Same thing for a signal trying to get out. Didn't matter what kind of signal it was. Cell phone, satellite phone, pager, walkie-talkie, police radio, whatever. It wasn't going to happen. The laws of physics couldn't be ignored. A signal couldn't get out because of the mesh. A person couldn't get out because of the bars. Patty took a look over his shoulder and said, "What is all that stuff?" Shorty tried hard to think of something cheerful to say, but he couldn't. So he didn't answer the question. Chapter 30 Burke and Reacher drove back to the turn where they headed south toward Laconia. Not all the way, just a few miles. Far enough to get bars on Burke's old phone. They pulled off on the shoulder of a wide left-hand curve. Ahead of them were fields and trees, and presumably the town itself on the other side of them in the far distance through the haze. Reacher took out Amos's business card and dialed her number. It rang twice and dumped to voicemail. She was away from her desk. He clicked off and tried again, this time with her cell number. It rang five times, and then it was answered. Her voice said, "Interesting." He said, "What is?" "You're calling on the Reverend Burke's phone. You're still with him. You're still in the vicinity." "How did you know this is the Reverend Burke's phone?" "I saw his license plate this morning. I checked with County. Now I know all about him. He's a troublemaker. He's been very nice to me. How can I help you?" "Something made me think about guys getting drafted in from Boston. Seems to be a regular habit around here. I was wondering how you were doing with that." "Why? Did anyone show up yet?" Amos didn't answer. Reacher said, "What?" "Chief Shaw is talking to the Boston PD again. They're calling in some favors. The word on the street is five guys are working out of town today. There's no sign of them at home. Their absence is conspicuous. It's a reasonable assumption they've been sent our way. In which case we know all about the first four. They were the guy in the Chrysler and the three in the library. It's the fifth guy we need to worry about. He left Boston much later than the others. We assume in response to a panic call from here. We assume he's their cleanup hitter. The ultimate sanction. Has he arrived?" "I don't know. We watch what we can, but we're sure to miss something." "When did he leave Boston?" "Long enough ago to be here by now." "With my description," Reacher said. "That doesn't matter anymore," Amos said. "Does it?" Then she paused. Then she said, "Don't you dare tell me you're coming back to town. Because you ain't, Major. You're staying away." "Relax, soldier," Reacher said. "Stand easy. I'm staying away. I'm not coming back to town." "Then don't worry about your description." "I was wondering exactly what it said. I was thinking back to exactly what the kid can have seen. The lighting was kind of patchy. It was an alley. There was a lamp over the door, but it was shaded. Like a cone. But even so, let's assume he got a pretty good look at me. Although it was the middle of the night, and most of the time he was mad as hell and spoiling for a fight. And then he was unconscious, basically. Therefore, his grasp of detail is not likely to have been impressive. So what would a kid in his position say afterward? I'm sure it hurt to talk. By that point, his teeth were in poor condition. I'm sure he had facial bruising. Maybe his jaw was busted. So what few words would he choose to mumble? Just the basics, surely. A big guy, with messy,